Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Last week, we told you about the serious events unfolding in Iraq, where city after city is under siege by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, otherwise known as ISIL. This is a splinter group of the Al-Qaeda terrorist group. As of last week, when we interviewed Ben Kalasha, one leader in the local Iraqi Chaldean community, we were hearing that 500,000 people were fleeing from the city of Mosul alone, and many other cities were in danger. Today, my very special guest is another leader in our local Iraqi Chaldean community, Mark Arabo, who is the president and the CEO of the Neighborhood Market Association. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I also have our intern, Trevor Hill, who has been helping us to research the situation in Iraq. Trevor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm going to let Trevor open up with the first question.
What can you tell us about what's happening right now in Iraq?
Well, right now, President Obama sent troops over there to secure the embassy because it's getting worse hour by hour. Families are going from city to city, and they're hoping to just survive and live. There are more and more killings. Images of mass executions are coming out of Tikrit, and once it was home to many Chaldean families. And now Sunnis are actually beginning to fight alongside with ISIS. And the reason is because from the onset, the Maliki government, they didn't allow the Ba'ath Party to participate in elections, which caused a deep-rooted resentment between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And for the Chaldean community at large throughout America, this is a living nightmare that won't go away. And we organized as a community, and we did a petition online. We've talked to our members of Congress. We talked to all the delegates in San Diego. We've spoken to our U.S. senators here and in Michigan. And we're doing everything we can. We're talking to the State Department as well. And we spoke to President Obama to say that we need to find a way for UN and NATO to come together and support a mass exodus of Christians and Chaldeans out of Iraq and a safe passage to other countries around the world, because there is no safe haven in Iraq. And no question about it, this is a slow genocide.
This must be absolutely terrifying for the people here in East County who still have family or friends or contacts, and I'd like to hear about that. But first, Mark, I'd like to know what reaction or response did you get from the elected officials that you've contacted thus far?
Sure. Well, we've had positive reactions from every public official we've spoken to. All the members of Congress in San Diego have been very supportive. They've told us that they're helping any way they can, and if that means bringing some Chaldeans to San Diego, then they're happy to help with that, and they want to elevate the issue as much as they can, and so they've been extremely helpful. We might announce something later this week about what our next steps, but I do want to really say from the Chaldean community and on behalf of the community, we're really thankful for our sons and daughters in the sense of our soldiers. I want to thank you to all of our soldiers that fought in Iraq. We've made extraordinary sacrifices for that country. Over almost 5,000 lives have been lost, American lives, for a misguided war that from the onset was flawed because they never secured the borders and they invaded Iraq, the 2003 war.
So you're talking about going back to the Bush administration, George W. Bush, and the original invasion of Iraq.
Right, but ultimately, the Chaldean community is so appreciative and so thankful to the American soldiers. And all the Chaldeans that have come to America are in love with America, because America is the best country in the history of the world. And no other country in the world can you have so much opportunity and freedom, and you could be whoever you want or do whatever you want, just play by the rules and work hard and study. And that's what we're hoping with this mass exodus. Mm-hmm. When they come to America, they're going to be the finest soldiers, teachers, doctors, lawyers, engineers, a good parts of the community and very patriotic. And
that really is the American dream. And it is. It's good to hear that there are still immigrants today who are able to fulfill that.
Yeah.
But that said, what are the stories that you're hearing firsthand from inside Iraq right now, from your contacts here in the community,
sure.
Mark?
Well, we receive numerous phone calls on a daily basis. One fellow's name is Johnny Mattia. His uncle and his godfather was in Mosul 6 days ago when they took over Mosul. Since then, he's lost contact with him and his cousins. So they don't know if they're alive, if they're not. We did a prayer service at our church. They're just telling us that they're having sleepless nights and long days. And this is a nightmare that won't go away, and asking us to help. Previously, Chaldeans would go to Syria and live in Syria and resettle to the States. Mm-hmm. But now Syria is just as bad as Iraq.
Yeah, going through its own civil war. And
so there's civil war in Syria. There's a civil war in Iraq. And there's no safe passage. And so we've been very vocal in saying we think that there should be a safe passage of Chaldeans and Christians all throughout the region to any, not just U.S., but any like-minded nation.
Yeah. For listeners who may not be familiar with the Chaldean culture, by the way, we should mention that the Chaldeans are the descendants of the ancient Babylonians in Iraq. They call themselves the first Christians from Mesopotamia, the true cradle of civilization, so to speak.
Right.
Trevor, you have some more questions.
I wanted to know approximately how many Christian Chaldeans do you think are in Iraq?
Last number we saw is around 450,000.
Wow.
And, you know, prior to the war, 2003, under George Bush, his invasion, we had around 1.2 million.
Wow.
So they've been fleeing the country because without a stable government and without someone looking after you, you can't survive. I do think right now we need to practice soft diplomacy. But I feel that more boots on the ground is not the answer. I think that the U.S. should work with like-minded nations, and the whole world community should come together, because this is more than just the Chaldean community in a certain region. This is has world implications on a massive scale. If that region is a tinderbox, and if they keep taking out city by city, the whole world's safety is threatened, and I hope that the world community acts soon.
So this could escalate into another world war, in your view?
You know, I think if they keep marching, if they never know, they might end up targeting Israel. If that happens, then I think we will be that level. We have to make sure that they cannot get a stronghold of Baghdad, because that's Iraq is an ally to the States, and we don't want our soldiers to die in vain. We've had extraordinary sacrifices as Americans, and we've given up our children, our blood. We spent billions of dollars, all that, for a misguided war in 2003 under George Bush for no reason. But now we have to pick up the pieces and push forward.
We should comment on that. I happen to have done an interview with Scott Ritter, who was the UN weapons inspector back at that time. And he was a conservative Republican who had worked in the Reagan administration, and yet he was speaking out at a Democratic convention when I met up with him, because he said there were no weapons of mass destruction. He was absolutely certain of it, and he was horrified that his report had been falsified by his superiors to show weapons of mass destruction that did not exist, specifically, he said, so that they could justify an invasion for whatever other ulterior motives apparently there were to launch this war, whether it was over oil or who knows. But I think that's a point that's very well worth noting again here,
we're
now reaping the consequences of that decision.
Yeah, and I also say that in 2011, President Maliki, he failed when he didn't do the status of forces agreement. When he didn't provide our U.S. troops immunity, then we had no other choice but to pull the troops out of Iraq. We've had so many extraordinary sacrifices in Iraq, and it's all crumbling within a month.
Yeah, it's astounding to many in the West that these supposedly well-trained security forces crumbled in a day in the case of Mosul, and that a lot of the leaders simply walked off the job and basically let the terrorists have their way. Why do you believe that happened? What are the seeds, other than, you know, the failed war, the war that shouldn't have happened,
sure,
perhaps to begin with? Is there anything else that could have been done to prevent or foresee this once we were in this situation?
Well, we agree, the community agrees with President Obama when he says that Prime Minister Maliki should be more inclusive in the sense that Sunnis should be part of his government, Chaldeans should be part of his government. And from the onset, when President Bush did not allow the Ba'ath Party to participate in free elections, if you're saying a certain party can't participate in elections, from the onset, you have deep resentment towards the groups. And it's just boiling over until we have today. And so the president has told the world that he wants the Prime Minister Maliki to make sure that he's more inclusive of everyone.
And can you elaborate on what that is, the Ba'ath Party?
Sure. The Ba'ath Party is, Saddam was from the Ba'ath Party, and it's a group in Iraq that are Sunni. So you have all these groups that always debate and try to get to be the next leader. So imagine if you had Republican and Democrats and you say, let's do an election and don't let Republicans participate. What would happen? And that's not exactly the same way, but it's similar to it. But that was a blunder. When they invaded Iraq, they'd never secured the borders, which was a huge blunder. Mm-hmm. They demilitarized the military, which was huge. They didn't have no armed services.
We might add that ISIL, a lot of these terrorists are coming right across the border from Syria, from what we understand.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that the United States should not give any more weapons to any countries that are as volatile, because when the Iraqi army right now retreated, basically, ISIS has American weapons now. They have our weapons.
And money. They went in and looted
$450 million from a bank, I think.
Yeah, almost half $1 billion that they now have. Some incredible amount of money and weapons and everything else.
I do think, though, last few times that I met with President Obama, speaking about Christians in Iraq, one thing that President Obama just met with was Pope Francis. And Pope Francis asked the president about Christians in specifically Iraq and the Middle East. This is a world's problem right now because it's world ramifications in a major way. I do think if President Obama asked for assistance from Pope Francis to bring everybody together, the Sunnis and the Shiites and Prime Minister Maliki, to do some type of peace, I might be an ideologue in the sense that it's a path less traveled in foreign affairs, but we've had so much blood shed. We've had so much sacrifices. I think we should add, if the president asked Pope Francis to intervene to help. I think right now when Pope Francis met with the Israeli and the Palestinians, that was a huge step forward for the communities. And I think something should be done in the Middle East because there has to be a way where everyone can live in safety. And prayers will keep going to all the families. And we're going to keep doing our petition. We keep talking to members of Congress and our senators and...
Is that petition online, by the way?
It is.
People want to sign it?
Is there absolutely
a link? Or if you want to send it to us, we can put it up on our site with this interview for people who may wish to sign it.
I will definitely email it to you. There was a great Chaldean leader in Michigan. His name is Nathan Kaleshu. He started. He does a great job. Mm-hmm. And we're working with him every day.
And for listeners who may have tuned in late, we're speaking with Mark Arabo, the head of the Neighborhood Market Association, about the terrible situation in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And we're discussing a petition that would call for the resettlement of Christians to be provided safe passage out of Iraq. We're seeing genocide going on now with a terrorist group that's taking over many of the cities there.
Yeah.
So we're seeing ISIL targeting Christians. Are they targeting anybody else? Do you know what their end goals are as far as what they're doing in Iraq?
Well, what they've said, based on reports from CNN and other news outlets, is they want to establish Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Right now, for the Chaldean community, we just want safety. And so we know that Chaldeans could make it anywhere. Any country they go to, as long as they got a shot, they give it equal chance, they have safety, they'll work hard. They'll work 20 hours a week, 7 days a week. And every Chaldean that's come to America until now is in love with America and will always be in love with America because it's easy to be in love with America. It's a great country, the best country.
Good to hear.
but like-minded nations, Israel, Australia, Europe, England, United States, we need to help a safe passage of these Christians to other countries.
It sounds like many of these may wind up here in El Cajon or in San Diego, and some of them in El Cajon East County, which has been designated as a refugee resettlement area. We already have, 30,000 or 40,000 Chaldeans or so in the East County and even more in the San Diego area?
I would say in San Diego area around 70,000. In East County, probably around 45,000. And, you know, the federal government, they do give grants for refugees. But last time I met with Congressman Duncan Hunter, he told me that the previous mayor, Mark Lewis, would never apply for any grants. So I don't know if the city of El Cajon knows.
Why was that? I mean, the refugees will come here anyway if the federal government decides. Yeah. So it's a question of, do you ask for aid from the federal government to help with things like teaching them English, resettling them, getting them job skills, basic living expenses, and so forth?
Yep.
Or do you turn a blind eye to what's happening and do nothing to help these people that are fleeing, probably in some cases with nothing but the clothes on their back?
Right, right. And I can say that it's the State Department that designated, the Immigration Service, they designated El Cajon as a resettlement area.
So what about the new mayor, Mayor Wells, Bill Wells?
Right.
Have you talked to him about this? Is he willing to apply for some grants? And if so, why not?
Well, the last time I spoke with Bill Wells was when they were able to successfully do a Cal the American Month in the city of El Cajon for September, which was a huge feat for the community at large. He said he's open to it. So I think that we got to have him and Doug Williford really apply for these grants, because
maybe they need help, a grant writing
possibly
experience
but,
or something.
But they need to take it seriously, and I think they are. They just had a really good festival on Saturday, I believe, and you know, there's some things that we would still like to see in El Cajon, but I think we're better now than we were before, and we're moving forward. But obviously, there's still more progress to make.
Yeah.
What would you consider the next logical steps as far as not just securing the safety of the people being persecuted? I know you support an exodus for the Chaldean Christians.
Right.
But what would you consider the next steps as far as securing the safety of the entire region, the stability that's been lost?
You know, I think the UN and NATO need to come together, and the world community needs to say that no country in any area should be taken over by a terrorist group, period. It's a multifaceted problem. It's a multifaceted solution. There's not one. I think President Obama is doing a great job in the sense that he's sending troops over there right now to secure the embassy. Do we have a Navy ship there in case we need to do airstrikes? He wants the Iraqis to secure themselves. He wants Prime Minister Maliki to be more inclusive. And I think you can't have a government in really anywhere in the world if you're not inclusive and be successful. The beauty and the magic of America is everyone's so different, everyone's included. And we agree and disagree. At the end of the day, we're Americans and we live peacefully. And elections happen and we live in safety. And I think that region needs to, you know, the Shiites should bring the Sunnis more and say, you guys should be part of our government. Bring the Chaldeans, bring the Kurds. And let's say, guys, let's do a government for everybody. But it needs to happen if everyone is included in it. But from the beginning of the war, 2003, if President Bush says a certain party can't participate in elections, that's like clapping with one hand. It can't be done.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ. And certainly our hearts go out to the Chaldeans and all of the Iraqi people that are going through such terrible times right now. We appreciate you coming on to talk about this, and we will have a link up there to the petition calling on the president and others to help provide safe passage for Christians out of Iraq right now, in addition to whatever other macro solutions the world stage seeks.
Sure. Thank you so much. Okay. My pleasure.
Thank you. You're welcome.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is Trevor Hill with East County Magazine on KNSJ with a missing persons report. A search is underway in Ramona to locate 66-year-old Carl Salayer, who was last seen when he went to bed Monday night. He left his home in the 17,000 block of Handlebar Road in Ramona between 2:30 and 6:30 Tuesday morning. He suffers from Alzheimer's disease and has other medical conditions and needs to take his medications. He had a feeding tube and may only be wearing his undergarments. He is white, 6 feet 3 inches tall, weighs 150 pounds with blue eyes, balding gray hair, and a mustache. He could run when approached, so if you see him, please call the Sheriff's Department at 858-565-5200.
The state is proposing to release a sexually violent predator in Campo at 1138 Custer Road. Alan Fields, a diagnosed pedophile, was convicted of molesting four boys ages 10 to 13 back in the 1980s. Fields established relationships with each of the boys as either their caregiver or as their Boy Scout troop leader. In 2000, after Fields served a 25-year prison sentence, the district attorney's office prevailed on a civil petition and Fields was committed to a state hospital as a sexually violent predator. Since then, he has remained in the hospital undergoing sex offender treatment. In March 2003, he voluntarily submitted to surgical castration. A decade later, in December 2013, the court granted his petition for outpatient placement, ruling that he could be safely released to the community for continued treatment and supervision. Supervisor Diane Jacob objects strenuously to Fields' proposed release in rural East County. "Here we go again," she said in a prepared statement. "The state is trying to unload yet another monster on a peaceful, family-oriented community. Although this convicted pedophile may have been castrated, residents lose serious quality of life each time one of these predators is dumped in our communities," the supervisor added. The public can submit comments from now through June 23rd on Fields' proposed release in Campo. A hearing will be held a month later, on July 23rd at 9 a.m. in Department 35 at the downtown courthouse. Public comments will also be accepted at the hearing. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The first day of summer may be on Saturday, but parts of California have already seen triple-digit heat this year, and more is on the way. With that in mind, health officials across the West are urging people to be careful in the potentially deadly heat. Henry Varela, a Health Department public information officer, says this is the time of year that it's easy to fall victim to heat exhaustion, which can cause serious health problems. He says those at greatest risk of heat-related illness are seniors and children.
Children's body temperatures rise at 3 to 5 times that of an adult. Therefore, when it comes to children, they're probably more at risk than anybody else.
Varela stresses that leaving a child in a hot car, even for a short time, can be dangerous and have negative health consequences. The CDC reports more than 650 people a year die from heat-related causes. Varela says the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reports in more than half of the cases where children have died from heat stroke in America in the past 15 years, the caregiver reported forgetting the child was even in the car. He adds that sometimes kids can sneak into an unlocked family car at home and get locked inside.
That's why it's always important for parents to be vigilant, not only when they're driving in the car with their child and going somewhere, but also when you're at home. Make sure your doors are locked so that your children can get in.
Varela adds that in the U.S., heat stroke is the leading cause of non-crash-related deaths in vehicles for children under age 14. This is Lori Abbott, California News Service.
Do you hate your health insurance? Do you wish you could voice your complaints about the insurance industry right from your home with minimal effort? Well, Consumer Watchdog, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization, has designed a website that will allow you to do just that. The website, properly titled, Your Health Insurance Company Sucks When... .org, allows users to quickly post a complaint regarding the negative aspects of their health insurance provider by finishing the sentence, Your Health Insurance Company Sucks When... Consumer Watchdog says that their website provides a forum for millions of people who are suffering at the hands of these greedy, uncaring companies. They encourage anyone to voice their complaints on their forum. But how do you know if your health insurance company sucks? Well, Consumer Watchdog says your health insurance company sucks if they have, 1, denied your coverage, 2, kept you on hold for hours, then told you there's nothing they can do, 3, raised their rates, deductibles, or co-pays for no good reason, 4, forced you to wait for hours for care, 5, botched your care, causing pain, anguish, and loss, and finally, cut your benefits. They state that the health insurance industry makes huge profits and pays its executives millions while hiking rates, cutting benefits, and providing often nightmarish care and service. Don't let them get away with it. For more information on the Consumer Watchdog organization, visit www.consumerwatchdog.org. To post your very own complaint about your insurance company, visit www.yourhealthinsurancecompanysuckswhen.org. This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
Nestle Purina Pet Care Company and Wagon Train LLC reached an agreement with pet owners in several states to create a $6.5 million fund to compensate dog owners who believe their animals were harmed by eating chicken and other jerky treats sold by the companies. This agreement comes after years of complaints by pet owners who claimed that jerky treats had made their dogs sick and sometimes killed them. The FDA, for numerous years, warned about the reports of illnesses in animals that ate chicken, sweet potato, and other jerky treat products from China. But despite extensive testing, no cause has been found for the illnesses. Even after the reports, the FDA did not assign blame on the Chinese-made treats or even hold the large American companies such as Purina or Wagon Train LLC accountable for selling the treats. But 3 weeks earlier, the FDA had linked the jerky treats, mostly made in China, to more than 1,000 deaths in dogs, more than 4,800 complaints about animal illnesses, and, for the first time, sickness in 3 people who ate the products. The public demanded action and filed a lawsuit against the companies. If approved, the settlement would also require Nestle Purina Pet Care Company to undertake enhanced quality assurance measures regarding pet treats made in China and to modify language on its packaging. In announcing the settlement filed in U.S. District Attorney Court for the Northern District of Illinois, neither party admitted fault. Nestle Purina and Wagon Train officials have consistently said that their treats have not been confirmed to cause any illnesses in animals and that the products are safe to feed pets as directed. PetSmart and Petco announced they would no longer sell jerky treats made in China. Neither Wagon Train, Nestle Purina, nor any of the consumers concede that their claims or their defenses were not valid, lawyers for the parties said in a statement. All parties entered into the agreement only to bring the litigation to a prompt and certain resolution. The terms of the settlement are outlined in a 150-page agreement. Cases settled include Atkins versus Nestle Purina Pet Care Company, Gandara versus Nestle Purina Pet Care Company, and Matten versus Nestle Purina Pet Care Company. The agreement is subject to a final fairness hearing and approval by the court. Consumers will be notified of the settlement and the date of the final hearing. For a complete look at the settlement, visit eastcountymagazine.org for a link to the PDF. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Jaden Jimenez on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today, we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now, back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian gold rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the gold rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who are the people who founded the town?
Basically, Dury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Dury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on the San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddlebags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Dury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Dury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Dury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s, and then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmith here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now, but
So these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those us? Those right there, yes. And
Wow. Those
were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist, S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary, mm-hmm. and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit, because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them, because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
hit a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury. This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian Mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People mm-hmm. are out there trying to get lucky. But say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Jaden.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain, because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real gold is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis, right. And those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and mm-hmm. you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the rigid. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors. Uh-huh. So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in the pan, I settle it, shake it. because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you, because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in 1800? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U-shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out, because the gold's heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Stevan over here who's been trying his hand at it. Stevan,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of good. And the techniques that Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! Your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call them adits, A-D-I-T. It's a cluster of puzzles.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel, because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured, and we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there, and we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there, and once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover...
Come back. Okay,
bye.
Guys.
We're going to cover...
Bye.
Bye. Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light. And they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a pneumatic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The pneumatic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet. And our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope, because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, Let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie. So we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things, like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes, got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore, worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center, ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and, of course, America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This is great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
The Grossmont Healthcare District Board has announced a vacancy after Board President Michael Long resigned on June 4th for personal reasons. On Friday, June 20th, the Board will consider how to fill the vacancy and whether to seek applications from community members to fill the remaining term of office that ends in December. An appointment must be made within 60 days after the vacancy occurs. Interested persons would be invited to submit an application, including qualifications and your reasons for wanting to serve on the board. Applicants would also be required to file a Fair Political Practices Act disclosure statement. Long is a retired neurologist who practiced locally for 40 years, including serving as chief of the medical staff at Grossmont Hospital. He was elected to the board in 2008 and again in 2010. Formed in 1952 to build and operate Grossmont Hospital, the Grossmont Healthcare District is governed by a board of directors, each representing over 500,000 people residing within the district's 750 square miles. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
On Tuesday, June 10th, experts in the field of drone manufacturing convened at a summit at the Liberty Station Conference Center to discuss the implications and details of the industry, which is currently booming in San Diego. The purpose of the conference was to discuss methods to promote the drone industry in California, which is quickly becoming the nation's drone capital. However, some other talking points included strategies for economic growth, as well as finding a healthy medium between supplying high-tech aerial surveillance equipment to the public and maintaining the privacy of Californians. Drone manufacturers want to capitalize on San Diego's workforce and geographical location in order to create the most efficient drone-producing industry possible. The San Diego Regional Economic Development Corporation describes San Diego County as a center for entrepreneurship and innovation with one of the most highly educated workforces in the world, more than 80 academic and applied research institutions, access to venture capital, and a thriving technology, military, and tourism sectors. It's no wonder that manufacturers want to build their factories here. However, drone manufacturers have seen strong opposition from San Diego residents. San Diego's desert climate is a double-edged sword for drone testing. While the large uninhabited deserts are perfect areas for flying drones, the dry heat means drone crashes have a very high risk of starting wildfires, something San Diegans are far too familiar with. Additionally, there are major concerns about privacy which need to be addressed in a serious way. Would allowing citizens the ability to spy on one another from the sky be ethical? And even if they weren't sold commercially or tested in San Diego, many residents would still have a moral problem with producing drones for military use, which is a highly controversial issue in the U.S. Because of pressure from San Diegans and especially East County residents, drone manufacturers are either going to have to work with the public and address its concerns or pack their bags and move somewhere else. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Trevor Hill.
The San Antonio Spurs defeated the Miami Heat 104-87 in Game 5 on Sunday night and took their fifth NBA title. The San Diego State basketball standout Kawhi Leonard was awarded the Finals MVP honor, becoming the third youngest player to be named Finals MVP at just 22 years of age. Drafted by the Spurs in 2011, he made a major impact during the series, scoring and on defense. Despite being a non-factor in the first two games, Leonard came on strong with aggressive play throughout the final three matches. Kawhi is someone who has overcome great challenges and risen to stardom. His father was fatally shot at the car wash he owned in Compton, California in 2008. The murder was never solved. It seemed fitting, then, that Leonard won his Finals MVP on Father's Day. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
Students graduating from college today face an increasing burden of debt. The average undergraduate student must borrow $30,000, and for graduate students, the burden is many times worse. The high cost of tuition, even at public colleges and universities, has made college unaffordable for many students. Aiming to help students, President Barack Obama signed an executive order on Monday requiring that people paying off student loans will not have to pay more than 10% of their monthly incomes. The measure will be retroactive, extending this benefit to millions of borrowers. The president also called on Congress to pass legislation that would provide even more reforms to help students. The bill is expected to be debated in the Senate this week, but it faces significant opposition from fiscal conservatives. In his weekly address to the nation, the president said that graduation is a time for students and their families to celebrate achievements. But he added, "For many graduates, it also means feeling trapped by a whole lot of student loan debt, and we've got to do more to lift that burden." The president noted that higher education is the most sure pathway into the middle class, since the unemployment rate for workers with a bachelor's degree is just 3.3%, about half of what it is for high school graduates. And the typical graduate of a four-year college earns $15,000 more per year than someone with just a high school degree. But despite an increase in student loans available under the Obama administration, the cost of college has continued to rise. Over the past three decades, the average tuition at a public four-year college has more than tripled. The president stated, "I've heard from too many young people who are frustrated that they've done everything they were supposed to do, and now they're paying the price."
A bill introduced by Senate Democrats would help young people save money by allowing them to refinance their student loans when interest rates drop, just as homeowners can refinance their homes at lower rates to reduce their payments. The president said, "We'd pay for it by closing loopholes that allow some millionaires to pay a lower tax rate than the middle class. That's the choice that your representatives in Congress will make in the coming weeks. Protect young people from crushing debt, or protect tax breaks for the millionaires. This country has always made a commitment to put a good education within reach of all who are willing to work for it. That's what's made us an economic superpower. That's what makes us special," the president concluded. "And as long as I hold this office, I'll keep fighting to give more young people the chance to earn their own piece of the American dream." This is Trevor Hill reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
If you're a customer in the Helix Water District, your rates will soon be going up again. But the rate hike will be lower than predicted earlier. The district previously announced an increase averaging 6.2% over the next 2 years. Instead, the board has approved a slightly lower increase of between 4.3% and 4.5%. That works out to just under $6 a month for a household using 25 units of water. Though for those using 100 units of water, the increase will be substantially more, over $29 a month. The scale back rate hike now proposed reflects changes planned by the San Diego County Water Authority, which will hold a public hearing on proposed rate changes on June 26. Helix will announce its budget on July 31st, with the new rates taking effect beginning the ratepayers' November bills. The budget is also expected to reflect a plan to pay down the district's unfunded pension liability over the next several years. The rate hike, while lower than forecast originally, still poses hardships for some lower-income consumers in the current economy, coming on the heels of several past rate hikes levied on water users. The district's ratepayers have done a good job in answering the call to conserve water during the drought, the district has said, but that poses a financial dilemma for the district, since ironically, the more its customers conserve water, the less money flows to the district to cover its costs for employees, repairs, and maintenance of water lines. This may not be the end of rising water costs. Deanna Verbecki, vice president of Helix Water District, has stated that the board still faces several unknown factors that could impact future rate decisions, including rainfall levels, severity of drought, and how much water ratepayers will conserve. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, this is Devon Marshall.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.